Well, I will present you one part of what we have made in my group in Paris with my colleague here. There is nothing to point or to...
Maybe behind the...
Behind.
No.
And
what's up there by the loudspeaker? Oh. Is there something?
Finger.
Yes, finger is good. I assume that you are good at fingers. Okay, so with my colleague here, and so all of these three topics are related to the topic of the KITP session. Thank you.
Here you go.
I prefer this one. It's dangerous. Okay. And well, as you can see, we spent a lot of years running after Jim Dietrich, some relative success, and into working on the multi-contact friction and the Rice, Rina, and Dietrich laws. And now it's over in the group, and it has led us to become interested in friction in single contacts. Running from.
I guess, is there a microphone? Yeah.
You need a microphone?
Well, they want to record you
okay.
For posterity, so. And we've fashioned a makeshift pointer. I don't know if there's a better pointer.
Okay.
Okay. What was the point? Okay, this had led us to become interested in friction in single contact from the ball and flat geometry to the okay, thank you, and even to the SFA. But well, this is rather preliminary, and I prefer to present things about friction and fracture of hydrogels and. Indeed, there are two parts in this talk, and I guess I will only be able to reach perhaps the end of the first part. But I will try to give the flavor of the second part if some of you are interested in further discussion about this point. So what are hydrogels? I know that all of us come from different fields, and probably that it's not... So the term gels in itself doesn't talk enough, so just a few precision. Hydrogels, for example, gel of gelatin, or synthetic polymer gels as polyacrylamide, or even very complex biogels such as cartilage, fantastic thing, which is basically a gel plus a lot of things. A gel for me is a cross-linked polymer is a cross-linked polymer network plus some solvent. As such, since it is a cross-linked polymer network, it has some elasticity, some rubber-like elasticity. The shear modulus depends on temperature because we are dealing with polymers. And J is KT over a length at the power 3. And this length, C, xi, is basically the mean distance between crosslinks within a chain, which for an ideal gel that I will refer to as, let's say, the semi-diluted gel, corresponds to the mean distance between crosslinks within the gel itself. It means that the gel is something like this, three-dimensional, okay, with this distance, C. Okay. Xi is typically of order 10 nanometer for the gels I will present. It means that the shear modulus is of order 1 to 10 kilopascals. So it's a very soft matter, but still elastic. Since it is full of water, basically as a whole, it is incompressible, and the Poisson modulus is very close to 0.5 for all purposes. It means that the Young modulus is three times the shear modulus. Okay, that's over for the elastic properties. Since it is full of solvent, it has also some poroelastic properties. It means that the polymer networks as a whole is able to diffuse in the solvent with a coefficient of diffusion, D. which reads kT over the viscosity of the solvent times the length, which scales with the length here, and which is very close to the mesh size of the network. This coefficient of diffusion is 10, is of order 10 to the minus 11 square meter per second. For people from the rock mechanics, which are used to work with poroelastic medium, I've put it some comparison here. The theory of poroelasticity enables the comparison between this coefficient of diffusion, D, which is the same here, and the Young modulus, namely D is E times, is of order E times a porosity coefficient divided by the viscosity of the solvent. Here, the porosity is of order C to the power 2, and is typically 10 to the minus 17 meter square. In Darcy, people from rock mechanics are used to use Darcy, which is a micrometer to the square. It is 10 to the minus 5. It is larger than the porosity. Okay, so for rocks, well, don't see. Well, I don't see what this means. But it means that the coefficient of diffusion for here for gels is much smaller than the coefficient of diffusion for rocks. So it enables the comparison between the coefficient of diffusion, collective diffusion of the network in the solvent. It's something you can access directly, experimentally, by quasi-elastic light scattering in gels. By quasi-elastic light scattering, you probe the collective motion of the network. Namely, the correlation decays with time with a characteristic time, which is this coefficient of diffusion times the square of the wave number. Okay. In rocks, it is a coefficient of diffusion of the it is the same. It is a coefficient of diffusion of, let's say, the relative motion of the elastic rock part with respect to the solvent. Okay.
Question. Is there no energetic contribution to the Fourier moduli in cartilage? It seems to be only entropic, or KT.
This is entropic, yes.
And even in cartilage, I would thought that it's purely entropic.
I cannot see much thing about cartilage. In cartilage, there are plenty of things in cartilage.
Okay.
And
okay, so yeah. An idealized hydrogel may be purely entropic.
No. Cartilage, well, I mentioned it because it is a gel.
Okay,
corresponds to gels like gelatin gels and polyacrylamide gels,
okay, so
which
that
behaves
like entropic.
But even for these, it's quite simplified. So it, just to give the flavor of the thing. You are right. So, talking about gelatin and polyacrylamides, we have two examples of gels belonging to grid families. The first one is a family of chemical gels for which the cross-linking is mostly covalent, so it corresponds to very strong and permanent gels showing very few, for example, creep and aging and so on. And the other family, so polyacrylamide belongs to this family. And the other grid family is made of physical gels for which the cross-links are very weaker and maybe a lot of physical cross-links, mostly involving H bonds and so on. And for gelatin, which is a physical cross-link, the cross-linking is very funny because it corresponds to, you know, there is with temperature, usually these gels are thermoreversible. It means that if you eat, you lose your gel, it melts. But if you freeze the gel, it retains its elasticity. And well, at a given temperature, there is a transition in the polymer. The polymer in gelatin is proteins. Okay, polymers are proteins, and these proteins show a transition between the coil and helix configuration, and part of the chain becomes an helix, and three helices can become bonded and make and form a crosslink. It mimics locally what happens in the native collagen from which the protein of the gelatin is extracted. And so these things are rather weak, are very badly known indeed, despite of years and years and decades of studies. It is badly known, especially it is what is not known is how it deforms, how it breaks, how it can slip, how it can unzip, and so on. But as a result, these things are rather weak. It means that the system ages when you take a piece of gelatin gel and wait for hours and hours and measure, for example, the shear stiffness. It evolves, it increases with time. When you submit your gel to a shear, for example, it flows, it slowly creeps. Okay? So it means that this gel, the network associated to the gels, to this gel, can be described as a transient networks. It is not there for the end of times. And thermal history is very important to describe the property of the gels, and it ages for everlasting aging, and it creeps. Another interesting difference between gels as far as friction is concerned is that some gels can be described as mostly adhesive, and other, well, let's say the interaction between the polymer network and a given substrate can be described either as adhesive or repulsive. Some gels are adhesive, some other are repulsive, depending on the polymer, depending on the pH, and so on. The adhesive gel shows real solid friction. It is the case of gelatin. If you put a block of gelatin on, for example, your computer screen, it adheres. And as we will see, if you want to have the block sliding, you have to overcome some static threshold and so on. This is the subject of this talk. Other gel are mostly repulsive, and there is also always a rather thick layer of solvent in between the gel and the substrate. And mostly there is no solid friction, there is no threshold, and what you have is something which flows hydrodynamically.
Okay.
So gel shows solid, gelatin shows solid friction. And I claim that gelatin gel is a model system because you can change a lot of things. You can change the content of protein, so of gelatin protein, with respect to the solvent. It means that you can change the shear modulus by an order of magnitude. And you can change also the viscosity of the solvent because you can form a gel with water or with glycerol or with mixture of both, and it is rather easy to tune the solvent viscosity with which it is rather easy to make a gel by a factor of 4. In addition, it is easy to cast, easy to handle, easy to cut, easy to mold, and so on. And it is possible to perform, as far as friction and fracture are concerned, to perform two kinds of experiments. This is the first part of my talk. This is the second one. The first part is, well, okay, let's form a block of gel. Let's fix it to an upper plate and put it into contact with a glass plate, a smooth glass plate, and try to make it slide and see what happens. And we'll see that what happens is interfacial fracture and then even ultimately sometimes sliding, and so it's possible to wonder about friction between gel and glass, or to study the interfacial cracks which propagates at the interface between gel and glass. Another possible simple experiment is to clamp the gel in between two plates and to make a notch and to study the propagation of mode 1 cracks into the gel. And that's the second part. Well, what about friction and fracture? Fracture and friction? Well, indeed, the question of friction and fracture occurs when you are dealing with sliding at extended interfaces. Extended interfaces, I mean system large enough, with material compliant enough, again surfaces smooth enough, so that it is possible to average to some extent, for example, over a lot of microcontacts, or to average over a lot of molecules, depending on the system, in order to be able to define a frictional stress locally, so to have a continuous mechanics description of the interface, and a system large enough for elasticity to play its role and to enable inhomogeneous sliding, inhomogeneous stress state at the interface. In such a way, it's possible to have parts sliding, so friction, and to have a frontier between sliding part and fixed sticking part, so you have fracture. And a funny thing, I like it, well, this is part of my own reflection about friction and fracture, it's not very deep, but it's funny to see that sometimes it's like this old story of the hen and the egg. Which of it was the first, and so on. And sometimes, well, you start from friction and try to explain some features of crack. For example, it's the thing Wright and Koshar, Benzayan, and so on, try to make when trying to find the good friction law, good for crack regularization, finding healing of the crack, we will come back to this, and so on. So you start from friction and try to explain features of fracture. Another point of view is to start from some fracture features and to try to explain some friction, global friction behavior. It's an old story, and last but not least, Gerd and Marder, I've followed this way in trying to explain the Hamilton's friction law, to give a possible explanation of Hamilton's friction law in crystalline perfect contact by the existence of some self-healing cracks at this interface. So it gave me a transition to the next slide and the last general hand-waving between giving some real result about real physics. This is a reminder on self-healing cracks, self-healing pulses, because it is also an old story, and it started, I think, with Chalamac. You have seen as a first movie, I have no time to show it again, but you have seen Chalamac waves. What are Chalamac waves? These are decohesion waves, the same thing as a propagating fold on a rug, you know. And this has been studied by Chalamac, who was working in the tire business, and in the 50s or 60s. And he observed for some soft rubber such waves, which are self-healing in the sense that decohesion at the end and re-sticking at the rear part. So it's observed when you have strong adhesion, when you have large deformations, and it is also observed some this kind of decohesion wave, as also been described by Marder recently. Another part of the story of self-healing cracks is well known of few people of the earth sciences. It is the Heaton, the so-called Heaton slip pulses, I think, which, if I well understood, have been first inferred from inversion of seismic data, and which nowadays are thought to be the way some earthquake or most of earthquake, I don't know, occurs along fault. And these are real slip pulses, which means that it corresponds to pulse propagating in between a non-sliding part of the fault, and a sliding one, and a non-sliding. Okay, and this propagates. This is the pulse. There is no decohesion necessary. From a theoretical point of view, this has been addressed by Adams in a very specific system where there is strong elastic contrast between both materials and, this is the key point, a Coulomb relationship between the shear stress and the normal stress at the interface. And this is a key point to find these pulses who are very special and probably not generic, but which are one of the few theoretical solutions for this localized sleep events propagating at an interface between elastic bodies. As far as I know, this is still a widely open problem. For example, what is the role of the friction law? It is well known now that the Coulomb law is associated to the ill-posedness to which it corresponds in the problem. It is essential to find these Adam pulses. Well, which friction law give rise to self-healing pulses? This is something which is still discussed. What is the role of elastic dissymmetry? Is it important to have a strong dissymmetry, for example, between gel, very soft gel, and the glass plate, very hard, indeformable glass plate? For which parameter, for example, velocity, driving velocity, can we observe such self-healing sleep pulses? So, well, I will address some of this problem with very specific system, so gel on glass, which a priori is very far from your wonder in earthquake science. But we'll see that, well, perhaps it's not so far, and that's why, partly why I'm here. And I hope I will stimulate discussion about this point. So, the system I have almost completely described previously. It's a finite size gel block, typically 1 centimeter high and 3 centimeter long and 1 centimeter wide, which adheres, no added, there is no added pressure on it. It simply adheres to a glass plate, so the system could be either horizontal or vertical. It won't change anything, since adhesion is rather strong. And the upper plate is driven through a spring which serves as a dynamometer, is driven at a constant velocity ranging between 10 and 2,000 micrometers per second. And here is what we observe. This is the global dynamics. What global dynamics? It is the average stress, so the measured force divided by the apparent, which is the real, indeed, the real area of contact here. So we define the average stress sigma with respect of time. The first trace here corresponds to a relatively high velocity of 150 micrometer per second. What do we observe? Here, this first linear part is the elastic loading of the block, shear elastic loading of the block. And at this point, the block, it appears that the block begin to slide. At least there is a stress drop, and then the stress reaches a plateau, a steady state, which corresponds to steady sliding of the block as a whole. Okay, so no surprise. The block acts like another block of PMMA, of granite, and so on. Now, if you lower slightly the velocity, the driving velocity, you observe another thing. Always the same loading part. The slope is lower because the driving velocity is lower. Again, a stress drop. Again, the trend to reach a steady state. And at some point, whoops, elastic loading resumes. And it's now we are in a steady periodic stick slip, seemingly stick slip regime. And when you further decrease the velocity, okay, still you have stick slip. And the only change is probably the length of the sleep part, which becomes shorter and shorter, and has shows no trend to reach a steady state before resuming loading. Okay.
So, yes. It also looks like there's a strong trend in the peak height with velocity.
Yes, not strong, but there is a trend. There is a trend.
0.8 to 0.5 or something. That's a change of almost a factor of 2 in the static friction with the fact.
Or 0.8, 0.7, 0.5, I guess. Yes, it decreases. It decreases. It decreases because the stick time decreases.
Is it the stick time, or is it related to the viscosity, the viscoelastic properties of the gel?
No. It is a matter, I think, a matter of stick time.
But the stick time is going the wrong way.
Hello.
When you go from the second to the top, from the middle to the top.
It looks like a direct rate dependence.
Well, look. Let's. If you focus on the steady state, the steady stick sleep, you know the amplitude here is almost from 0.3 to 0.6. It's almost 0.3. Okay, so the stick sleep amplitude is 0.3, and here it is also very close to 0.3. Okay, so the amplitude doesn't move with velocity so much. Now, if you look at the first load, it depends on the past history of the contact. I do not guarantee that the aging time has been the same for both experiments.
But it's also true if I take a viscoelastic material and I strain it at higher rate, I will see a higher peak stress just from the viscoelastic effects at higher velocity. So I'm wondering if that might be...
The gel is very slightly viscoelastic, especially at these frequencies, namely time or frequency. Okay, so for typically a few hertz, the tangent delta is 10 to the minus 2 and so on. So it's very purely elastic at these frequencies. So I don't know. Well, perhaps we can discuss this point, but I think that...
Would there be some sort of incubation or nucleation time for pulses?
Yes, there is. There is. It depends. The first pulse... we will see that indeed there are some fracture propagating here, and the first one is nucleated at a stress level, at an average stress level, which depends on what you call the incubation time or the aging time or the time at rest, and so it depends the way you have prepared your interface. Okay, so at a critical velocity, which indeed, if I come back, appears to be in between those two velocities. So at a critical velocity Vc, indeed stick slip disappears when going from here to here, or stick slip appears when going from here to here. So bifurcation, because it is a bifurcation, the bifurcation occurs at finite amplitude. It means that on decreasing velocity, the first stick slip which appears, it's at finite amplitude. And when stick slip disappears, it disappears with stick slip, which still has a finite amplitude. Okay, it's an indirect hot bifurcation, no problem. I know that this bifurcation will be associated to hysteresis, naturally. Unfortunately, there is no hysteresis. It's impossible to observe hysteresis. And so it's rather puzzling. And indeed, it suggests that it is not a bifurcation of a single degree of freedom or 1 or 2 degree of freedom system, but that there are internal degrees of freedom which are hindered inside the system. And what are these internal degrees of freedom? Well, it is a fact that since the system is very soft, there is no reason for the sleep field to be homogeneous, and indeed it isn't. Indeed it isn't, and it is possible optically, since the glass is transparent and the gel is transparent as well. It is possible to look through the contact, and well, if you look through the contact, you do not see anything. Indeed, it is very different from the picture, the movie I've shown at the beginning of the speech, where you can see some black things traveling the contact. Indeed, these black things were the fold in a rug, the Shalamak waves I've mentioned previously. And you can see them because there is decohesion, so there is a contrast between the rubber and the air, optical contrast, and it is rather easy to see them with naked haze. There is nothing like this here. If you look at through the contact, you don't see anything, except if you focus on the small optical inhomogeneities, which is a politically correct way of saying dust and bubbles. But well, even the small optical inhomogeneities, namely a small fluctuation in concentration in the gel and so on, diffract light. And it is rather easy to follow these defects, and they act as markers of the slip field, of the slip displacement at the interface. And so what we have done is to register to take a line of a CCD detector here, so a line to visualize a line of the contact in this direction, in the middle of the contact. So this is the contact seen from below. You take a line, and this line is here. And 1 millisecond after, well, let's say 20 milliseconds after, you take another line, another picture. It is here, and so on. So time goes this way, and this is space. Okay. This is the leading edge of the contact, this is the rear edge of the contact. So you notice that due to the finite size of the block, this is under compression and this is slightly under tension. And what do we observe on this spatiotemporal representation? For example, follow this line, it is vertical. It means that the dust doesn't move with respect to the glass. Okay, this is in the framework of the glass plate, and this is moving. So the dust doesn't move with respect to the glass. It means that at this point, the gel is stuck to the glass. Okay, as you can see, at time t equal to zero, this is the average stress with respect to time, and you see that we are in the elastic loading part of the stress field of the stress versus time characteristics. So the response is elastic, and indeed, actually, nothing moves. All the traces are straight lines, straight vertical lines. Okay, nothing is moving. But at this time, t naught. At this time, you can see that the straight line begins to curve, okay? And I don't know if you... Well, probably you can see it. There is some discontinuous line which propagates this way and which corresponds with the triggering of slip. Let's follow this one, okay? A straight line, and a change in the slope, okay? And then the dust particle moves with respect to the glass plate. Okay, the displacement here from the prolongation of the straight line gives you directly the slip length. Okay, the derivative or the slope of this curve gives you the slip velocity. It's rather easy to interpret. So what is this line? It is a discontinuity line which propagates and which triggers, which correspond to the triggering of slip, the onset of slip at a given point. Okay? And it propagates because it has some slope. Okay? So it propagates at a given velocity, which is given by this slope. So here we have evidence of a crack, an interfacial crack tip propagating from the rear end, so nucleating at the rear end, which is under tension, okay? And unzipping the contact, unzipping because at a given time it separates the contact in within one part which is still sticking and one part which is sliding. Okay. So this is a crack which crosses the system, and it ends at the leading edge of the block. Okay, it's finished. It corresponds to this. Okay, and here everybody is sliding. Notice that the sliding velocity is not homogeneous. It is stronger here than here. Okay. Well, okay, except that at this point, T1, it's much more difficult to see because the discontinuity is less pronounced, at least on the picture. And at this point, the sliding thing begins to restrict. Okay, you have to believe me, but if you follow the slope here, there is now a rupture in slope, a change in slope, a discontinuity in the slope, and here the trace is purely a straight vertical line. So there is something propagating at a velocity very close to this one, which corresponds to the triggering of rehealing of the interface. Okay, so here now you have a sliding part and a rehealed sticking part. Well, on this picture, which is here for the purpose of, let's say, clarity, you see that the healing front is nucleated at the rear end, is nucleated at a time where this front is going out of the contact. So there is no, technically speaking, there is no pulse at any time, there is no such a pulse in the finite size contact. In other cases, for other velocities, it is perfectly possible to observe real slip pulses, self-healing slip pulses, namely at a given time. Imagine that the healing front would be here. At a given time, you will have a sticking part, a sliding part, a sticking part within the contact at a given time. Okay, so this is not the case here, but we have observed many of these self-healing slip pulses. And here we do not observe them because of the finite size of the contact. I think so. Notice that the tip velocity here, which can be extracted from the slope of this discontinuous line, is of order, what is here, 8 millimeters per second. It means that even for a gels for which the shear waves is rather, the shear wave velocity is rather low, typically of order meter per second, it means that this crack is strongly subsonic. So we are far from earthquake, because, well, it's very slow crack, very slow earthquake crossing the fault. And also there is no decohesion. You cannot see any macroscopic decohesion. And so it is really a slip pulse. Well, this can be put on a more quantitative foot. Excuse me, it is in French, but the English version made my Mac collapse so well. My Mac doesn't like it. So it is in French. This is the slip distance. Okay, the slip distance, the distance, so this is time. This is the slip velocity, and this is the distance with respect to the tip, measured in the moving framework of the tip. So this is the slip distance, okay, with respect of time for three different loading velocities, and this is the slip velocity, simply the derivative of this curve, for this one, for the 90 micrometer per second, for the blue curve. This is the derivative. So velocity is here. Slip distance is here. So this is for the let's focus on this one only. Time zero is the time at which the crack tip occurs at a given position. Okay, so here at this time slip is triggered, and the slip distance increases. But its slope decreases, so the slip velocity at the beginning is very high because the slope here is almost vertical. sleep velocity is very high. This is not a surprise. There is a crack working here. It's very high and it decreases rather rapidly towards a velocity which should be the driving one. The steady state here should be everybody sliding at the driving velocity. So it decreases and try to reach this velocity, which is here, below this red discontinuous line. Okay, it goes this way. But at this time, when the local sliding velocity reaches, sleep velocity reaches a velocity Vc, which is nothing else than the critical velocity I've mentioned from the global dynamic of the system. When it reaches Vc, suddenly it restricts. We cannot follow the stopping of the pulse, but suddenly there is a discontinuous jump in velocity from Vc to zero. Okay. So,
excuse me, have you explored that at all with changing the stiffness, or I guess the thickness of the gel?
No. No.
Yeah. I presume that if you get to a stiff enough system, you'll be able to make.
We'll come back to this. Okay. Well, it should be very difficult.
I was going to ask a variant of the question. I'm just curious whether the logarithmically rotating interface singularities first identified by Williams play a role here. If that were the case, then there would be a logarithmic dependence upon the height of the system that might be interacting with the phenomenon there.
Okay. So these are two different remarks indeed, and your remark will come back to later when we will try to understand why there is such a discontinuous jump. Okay. Okay. So everything is like, well, everything is like it is almost finished, and everything is like it's impossible locally. It's impossible for the gel to slide at a velocity which is lower than this Vc. Okay, and now we come to physical interpretation of these results, and what remains to be explained. First of all, we have to explain the origin of this tip velocity, 8 millimeter per second remain, and the critical velocity, 100 micrometer per second. So notice that there are three velocities, characteristic velocities of the system. The velocity of shear waves, meter per second, Vc, VTIP is here, excuse me, VTIP, millimeter per second, and Vc, 100 micrometer per second. So seemingly it corresponds to very different physical mechanism. The first thing we have shown is that VTIP, so the crack tip velocity, scales with the poroelastic velocity you can form by dividing the collective diffusion coefficient by the mesh size of the system. If you plot this velocity, the VTIP with respect to VPRO, this can be changed by changing concentration and the mixture, the solvent, water glycerol mixture, and so on. And clearly, there is a linear dependence between VTIP and VPRO. Okay. So it means that indeed, what is at work is some dissipation, strong dissipation induced by viscous friction at a scale which is of the order of the mesh size. Okay. So well. If you are interested, I can come back on the qualitative picture we think helps to understand the fact that VTIP scale with VPRO, but unfortunately, I think I have no time. The fact is that we never observed crack going faster than this velocity, VPRO. Well, VPRO times 2 or 4, okay? With this geometry, The crack can accelerate because it imagines that the block is infinite. Well, the crack can accelerate into the stress field, and it seems that it cannot go faster than this velocity, than this vapor row, which correspond to some diffusive mode existing in the proelastic medium. So it reminds us of what Mike Marder told us yesterday. For rapid crack in elastic media, which cannot propagate, or sometimes cannot propagate at velocities larger than the relay waves, which correspond to one mode, elastic mode in the system. And here the question is it possible to propagate a crack at V larger than V per rho? And it is an open question. I have no answer yet, experimental answer yet, nor theoretical. And my last transparent will be for trying to explain the physical mechanism at work when the gel suddenly restricts at a finite velocity and on the spot, so at VC. It suggests, of course, that this is an unstable. There is an instability at work because it's so sudden. And what could be a good candidate for an instability? Well, it would be a rheological instability. What do I mean by rheological instability? If I measure in steady sliding, so for V larger than VC, if I measure the global stress, I find something which increases with velocity. Okay, and we have changed the viscosity of the gel and so on, and we have proved that this indeed can be explained as the viscous stress of a sheared, very thin, nano-thin layer of solvent plus chains, free chains flowing in the solvent. So in this part, everything indicates that we are in some, let's say, lubricated regime where the gel, once the first crack has unzipped the interface, the gel slides on a thin, very thin, 10 nanometer thick, 10 nanometer for the mesh size, which is the characteristic length of the problem, a 10 nanometer thick layer of water plus chains.
So constant film thickness.
Yes, with a constant film thickness, everything is okay. And if you extract the velocity from this, well, you find something which is shear thinning. And shear thinning, the way a bulk mixture of water and polymer chain is shear thinning. There is apparently no surprise here. Okay. Now, of course, it is impossible to measure this characteristic below VC because below VC, sliding is not possible.
So if you lose the hole, instead of water, you get larger fluid too?
Excuse me?
If you lose the hole, oui? Instead of water, you get higher friction.
Yes, yes. You get higher friction, but everything can be collapsed on a single master curve, provided you define a correct viscosity, effective viscosity, which depends, of course, on the solvent viscosity. But this suggests that at this point, perhaps, the characteristic will be velocity weakening. Of course, now if it is velocity weakening, and since the gel is very compliant, unless it would be very thin, but I guess that we will need to be very, very, very thin, probably as thin as the mesh size or something. Well, since the gel is very compliant, we are almost locally working at constant stress. Okay, so imagine that you decrease the velocity, and behind the tip, the local slip velocity decreases. So locally, you follow this. You follow this characteristic, and at this point, the next point is zero. Okay, so it's a characteristic picture for some rheological, or let's say, sliding instability. Okay, so the question is it a correct picture? Is this a correct picture? Well, answer, first, experimentally, I cannot access this. The only thing I can tell is that, well, it seems to be a change in curvature, indicating a trend to saturate and so on, but I'm not really convinced. So experimentally, it's very difficult. Now, is there some good reason to think that it would be the case? And the good reason has been given by the same Chalamac, but not within the framework of the Shalamak waves. Mm-hmm. Shalamak also has provided us with a very simple and effective model of rubber friction before Bo comes. It was the prevailing model. And this model is rather simple. And here, I won't describe it in details, but what is the story? Here, I tell you that the chains probably are flowing. They are flowing because they are no longer attached to the adhesive sites. They are no longer attached to the adhesive site because first, they have been detached by the loading, and second, because they have no time to attach. When they flow over an adhesive site of the glass, they flow over it very, very fast. And if they have no time, if their relaxation time is longer than the time of flight, they don't have time to lose their energy and to really effectively adhere. So probably for velocity larger than this, the time of flight, which is R over V, with R a kind of a radius of capture of an adhesive site on the glass, probably a few angstroms, this time of flight is much shorter than the rebounding time T. Now at VC, and VC in this picture would be given by the ratio of the radius of capture and tau, at VC, now the chains have time to find their way down the energy potential and to readhere. As soon as one chain has readhered, of course, this adds some elastic recoil locally, and it further decreases the velocity. If the velocity further decreases, there is more time for the other chains to readhere, and so on. And this is the motor for the instability. And of course, here, this part would correspond to a decreasing number of effectively adhered proteins as the velocity increases, or an increasing number as the velocity is decreased. So within this picture, well, we can understand that there should exist something like this. And what about the order of magnitude? If you take for the radius of capture a few angstroms, if you remember that VC is a few hundred micrometer per second, it would give a tau, namely a rebounding time of order 10 to the minus 6 seconds, which is smaller or the order of the Rouse time of the free chain of length xi, namely 10 nanometer. So it doesn't sound so stupid, and we think that this is some reasonable picture which would explain the existence of rehealing of this of these interfacial pulses. And the conclusion of this, because I will conclude, the conclusion of this is that probably in order to understand the existence of self-healing sleep pulses, it is very important to have a sleep characteristic with a minimum, in some sense. And I think that within the framework of the Rice-Dietrich law, we can wonder whether it is always velocity weakening or whether there is a minimum. And you know, Jim, that there is a minimum in the force velocity characteristics. And now, probably, perhaps, I hope, that's what this work is perhaps more relevant than it appears to, let's say, the earthquake mechanics from a very specific and short point of view. This sum up is very long. Just mention that here, with this finite size block experiment and setup, the crack is always nucleated at the rear end of the block. It is a natural nucleation site. So you can wonder of what will happen if there is no edge, namely if you work with an annular edge-free system. And in this case, there is another phenomenology. And for example, you can observe with a gel against glass, gel on glass system, but with no edge, you can nucleate on different weak patches you can nucleate self-healing sleep pulses, and you sometimes you observe two contrapropagating self-healing sleep pulses, one in the favored direction corresponding to the global driving direction, and one other which goes in the opposite direction, even if sleep is always in the good one. Okay, so these things you can observe in a simulation of, for example, benzion and coworkers, and it's things that happens in a simulation of faults. So with self-healing sleep pulse, which propagates, of course, at meaningful velocities from the point of view of earthquake. So the conclusion is there anything relevant to fault dynamics? And I hope this will stimulate a discussion with our colleague from Earth Science. Voilà, thank you.
Could you go back to the bulk properties where you showed the stabilization with bulk effects?
Of the?
Early on you had a slide of, I think you called it the bulk, sliding at different speeds, and you had the oscillations and then the steady one right there, yes. I've observed something that is directly, in even in detail, just like this in rocks. And I was able to model, I didn't never publish it, I was able to model it. And it seemed to be associated with not a reversal.
Exactly what you mean by exactly the same.
Just look at those curves. Every aspect of those curves, okay?
But in specific.
Specifically, the at higher at higher slip speeds, the peaks decay, and as you go to higher slip, as you go to a higher slip speed. I'm sorry, that's a.
That's the opposite.
Is the opposite, to a lower slip speed. As you go to a lower slip speed, sliding stabilizes. But really, every feature of those curves, the peak heights, the change in slip speed. And I was able to model it quite precisely, not as a reversal in the steady, this is a rate and state context, mm-hmm. not as a reversal of the steady state sliding strength, mm-hmm. but just as a break in the slope, so that in the particular experience I did, we're very close to the stability instability transition, and just by loading at a slower rate, I was able to.
But your model had a single degree of freedom. It was block sliding.
Yeah.
Okay, this is not the case.
I had one term for the rate state formulation that changed the. So it's just it seemed to be a very analogous phenomenon.
Yes, just looking at the global dynamics, it's not you can think of a lot of things. But the key point is that finite amplitude bifurcation, no hysteresis. Yeah. There is something wrong. It cannot be
so
a single degree of freedom.
Finite amplitude at which the stick slip was. Still big there, when it suddenly disappeared.
Okay, this is an important feature.
I would ascribe it to a break in slope and a steady state behavior, because if you remember from kind of the spring slider stability criteria, that the critical stiffness of the for sliding depends upon the difference between the A and B coefficients, rate and state friction, which is the steady state sliding. Mm-hmm. So if you can move from one sliding regime to another, you can go from stability to instability just by changing the
Well, but then by changing your stiffness, you could have checked.
And that's why I asked my question.
And in your system,
you're able to tighten the stiffness up on this.
And what was your system? Do you have any reason to think that there could be some pulses? Because
on a large scale, we do see.
I cannot model this with a single degree of freedom because there are many.
We do see on our big apparatus. We do see creep pulses moving across sample prior.
It was in the big apparatus. What you described.
I'm sorry.
What you described when you tell us that you observe exactly the same thing. It was this a big thing.
Yeah, we have a machine that has a 2 meter I had a machine, I don't know anymore, that had 2 meter falls in it. And as we load that up, approaching an instability, we do see creep events moving at different speeds across the sample from a few meters a second to hundreds of meters a second. So there's some analogies.
Yes, probably. It's rather easier to see self-healing sleep pulses with gelatin.
Yeah.
But, well, Feinberg has shown pulses, not pulses, but, well, cracks.
Yeah.
Perhaps pulses, but we don't know.
This sort of decreasing amplitude but not dropping to zero before you go to steady sliding also shows up in some of the surface force apparatus.
Exactly.
Frequently there, near the transition, you have an intermittent regime where you'll see steadying sliding for a long time.
We have the same. We have exactly the same.
So in that sense, there's not sort of a single critical velocity, but maybe a range. In our simulations,
what we observe, you see also in simulation, what we have observed is that very close to the, unfortunately I have not the picture, but I can find it. But well, very close to the threshold, to VC, it's possible to have, let's say very close to VC, this part is very long because it corresponds to the interface sliding and pacing down to the driving velocity, but ultimately it reaches VC and it's finished. But it's very long. It's very long, but sometimes you had some isolated events. Small ones, big ones, okay. And the small ones, for example, corresponds to pulses which are nucleated on some patches within the contact and which propagates in the two directions, okay. So locally, there is, let's say, a strong spatio-temporal complexity in very close to VC. Why is it only very close to VC? I don't know. But very close to VC, the thing becomes very, very, let's say, noisy, but the noise corresponds to nucleation of events in the contact. So what is surprising is, as you mentioned, this is very close. All these features you can find in traces published by Israel Ashvili and co-workers, especially this very long tail ending by a new stick. What could be the stiffness, the compliant part in the SFA, the glue? I don't know. I don't know if we have a good reason to think that there could be some pulses in the SFA. I don't know. Perhaps dilation pulse, because they often see region with two or three layers separated by region with one or two, but I'm not sure, but it is very surprising that the phenomenology is very close,
they,
apparently.
They certainly don't see any two-layer to three-layer type difference. So
sometimes you can see.
Well, but not during this.
Not during this. They don't see, perhaps. Well, okay. That's it. Mike.
So the fact that there are these very different systems that are showing the same phenomenology please suggest it's looking for an explanation that doesn't depend so much upon the detailed features of each one. The explanations that you've given largely focus on the rheology of the polymers. The self-healing pulses that I'd investigated were obtained with systems of masses and linear springs, and that was it. Those were the whole, those were the ingredients. So really what was generating the complexity were certain features of mechanics. That makes me curious to know whether the mechanics alone can potentially explain some of this. I can make up stories that would even enable me to get something like a VC, but I have no idea if it actually works. But the story would be that the mechanics change the stress field near the tip from one that is slightly tensile to one that is slightly compressive at a critical velocity. And that might be a mechanical thing that doesn't depend upon rheology at all. The test of it would be system height or its fitness.
Didn't your model require having the pulse propagated supersonic?
No. Those were all subsonic.
All subsonic.
But very close to this speed.
No, they were all over the place. There were many, many, many pulses going at, with different lengths, going at different speeds, but they were all subsonic. And that's all I have to say. They were at zero temperature, which means that there were velocity gap type effects, which I know go away at. In non-zero temperature.
Of course, in your system, the rest ticking time is very short.
Yeah.
Because it's a, let's say, a elastic time, a sound.
That's all true, but the question is whether mechanics alone can explain some of this. That happened to be a system where the mechanics could all be worked out in detail. But really, most of it was contained in a continuum arguments about the structures of propagating things, and the particular system we proposed was just one where you could really dot all the I's and verify that the guesses about consistency could all be you really could have a system that did everything we guessed the continuum would do. But most of the features were just continuum mechanics.
Well, the existence of VC here in the system, so the existence of some rehealing process, is only bound to the existence of a minimum in the friction velocity characteristic.
Right.
And the minimum, you have plenty of, in many systems, you have plenty of good reason to think of a minimum. You know, well.
I'm saying even without that.
I agree with
you.
Oh, even without.
There are no rate effects.
Without anything, well.
No rate effects at all. Nothing. Just masses and springs. And nevertheless, it started producing an awful lot of this. So that's your real independence of rheology.
You desperate the experimentalist because your rubber is not a rubber, your gel is not a gel, it's something which has no feature. It's terrible for us. And for Bo too.
I
agree that probably most of these features are not gel dependent. Of course the values, of course the real mechanism, but I agree that probably you can design some system with very simple rules which would apply to a lot of things, gels or rocks and so on. But, here the values are corresponds to things that are related to the gel itself.
Do I understand why the dual case, both stopping and starting, occur at the end points?
Yes. 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 Stopping of.
Have an infinite system. Will they cross along the line, or they cross in points?
Along lines.
But if
as far as I know, along lines.
If you have an infinite system, it will probably cross in points inside.
Okay. Now, if the system is infinite, well, like in the annular thing, it is triggered on the weakest part of the interface. There are always weak parts. Either you can do as people from earthquake model do in simulation. You introduce a patch of low velocity, low friction, for example, a PTFE, a Teflon rubber at the interface. So it triggers the first thing. And the interesting fact is, after the first object has been nucleated, often. Let's say you can imagine that there would be a self-healing slip pulses running and running and running infinitely. This can be observed, but this takes a long time to settle in general. What you observe is are small event triggered anything, anywhere, well, let's say on the weak part, and this thing propagates and sometimes die somewhere, or two things propagate and die and meet again and die at one point. And this gives rise to a new point, which will be a nucleation site for the next one. And so, for a transition period, you have a lot of very complicated events. I have in my office a pile of a lot of spatiotemporal picture showing a lot of bizarre events going everywhere. And this ultimately leads to a very inhomogeneous stress distribution along the fault. And discussing with Jeff Einberg, I found that in his PMMA glass or PMMA system, he has the same. A lot of small, he calls them the foreshocks, which settles a very inhomogeneous states. And this is on this very inhomogeneous state that the big seismic event will propagate. And in the annular system, the big seismic event can goes round and round and round. So it's a terrible earthquake, which never ends. But well, this is a point. There is a long transient in this system, and Jay has observed the same in this in his system.
Can you pull even slower than this?
Yes.
Why does he pull very, very, very slow? Does yes. the transient last even longer?
If you go very, very, very
microns.
slow microns and so on, with the finite size system, there is nothing special. Except that it takes a very long time to nucleate. Let's say the recurrence of the earthquake is very long. Okay. Now, in the annular system, it is another thing. But the annular system is rather tricky because you have to, if you want to look at a steady state, you have to provide the system with the right amount of energy which is dissipated. The energy here is dissipated essentially by viscous dissipation within the slip part. Okay, so imagine that you drive your system at a given velocity. The existence of a steady state is not assured, and in fact, the steady state can be obtained with either with one or two or three pulses propagating at velocities which this time are very different from the tip. Okay, from the V-tip, from the V-poro I've described here. Now, with a finite block, low velocity, no problem. It's no difference. With the annular system, at low velocities, you start to see the coexistence within the annulus of several pulses propagating at a velocity which is not fixed by the poroelastic properties of the material, but which also depends of the rate at which you feed the system with energy. Okay, so it becomes very complicated.
I'm not sure you're going slow enough. I'm trying to probe your regime where it's velocity.
But Bruce, rather than it being going slow enough, one of the things the simulations we've heard about so far is that we have very little disorder in the properties of the fault, that you tend to see just this sort of periodic big earthquake phenomenon as opposed to the more complex behavior. If you were just to do a partial silanation of your glass to create very large variations locally in the strength of adhesion, you might be able to nucleate micro fractures at smaller scales. Is this something that could happen and make the low velocity behavior more complex?
Yeah, but if
you
really have velocity weakening and he has a
no, you cannot you cannot probe the velocity weakening because
no, that's what I'm saying. Just if you really have velocity weakening at the low velocities and you have a long angular system and you drive it slowly, it should get complex. Even in a homogeneous system.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
That has what you mentioned has motivated the first study of this system by Galeano and Rubio, and it was at the time where Carlson and Langer studied their model of earthquake, and they have focused on the way the behavior at low driving velocity, the behavior of their model fault was correctly described by the Carlson-Langer model, and it was. They observed many features corresponding to this. And I think that is because you have a velocity weakening part, of course you have complexity, and indeed you have. I agree. Yes. So while this has been done, the low velocity study has been performed by Rubio and Galeano, only focusing on the spatiotemporal complexity of the system.
Right. So I was trying to get that as a way of probing that regime, which there was some question as to what was actually causing your phenomenon you're seeing, which you're ascribing to this sort of friction, which if it is going that way, you should see those sorts of things.
Well, it's difficult to infer the good friction law from the observation of the complexity. From the other way is rather easy, but the way back, extracting the good law from the complex behavior, well, you are welcome.
But you haven't tried purposely creating disorder on the interface?
We have tried. It's difficult. I have nothing to tell more. But well, you can think exactly of salinization, local salinization, and so on. But
sand your glass plate. Hmm? It doesn't have to be the gel you can make the glass from. Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes.
And that's difficult?
Well, making the glass rough is not difficult. It doesn't seem to make some huge difference, roughening the glass. It doesn't a strong effect. But salinization has an effect. Salinization has an effect. If you slide on a salinized glass, well, what would you expect to happen?
I don't know what
salinization is. Salinization is a passivation of the glass plate. Clean glass is a very high energy surface, so it is wettable by water. It's possible to graft molecules, silanes, with some ends, organic ends, which makes the plate non-wettable by water. Okay. So when it is salinized, well, water doesn't like it, and it becomes a lower energy surface. So friction of a gel on a salinized glass plate, what do you think happens? The friction is higher or lower in steady sliding?
I'm gonna guess higher, depending on the salinization and how big the chains are. Yeah.
Yes, it is higher. It is higher because water doesn't like the salinized plate, so it is repelled from the surface, and there is more proteins to be absorbed. Of course, there are less absorbing sites, but more molecule to be absorbed. So, well, the result, non-trivial, the result is, you are right, that the friction increases. So you can think of patterning the plate with silane, but, well, up to now, we did not manage to find a system with interesting results, reproducible, and so on. So, well, it's finished.
The scrap that you are describing here, you are probably more or less the contact in between the gel and the glass, right?
Mm-hmm.
So will that crack propagating in the middle of the gel show the same phenomenology or very different?
You mean a mode one crack?
Yeah, in the middle.
Well,
that is not, you know, detaching the gel from the crystal surface. Something that really...
Something like this.
Breaking bones.
Something like this? So this is a glass plate. Yeah. Okay. Well, it doesn't show the same phenomenology. We have studied this because we wonder whether the poroelastic velocity I've described, d over xi, would have an effect here. Is there something to be seen when the crack tip velocity crosses this poroelastic velocity? And with such a geometry, it's rather, you know, a single notch system. It's rather easy to drive the crack at a prescribed velocity. You just strain the system, so you increase the fracture energy, the free energy which you can release by propagating the crack, and the crack goes faster and faster. And what we have observed is that apparently there is nothing to be seen at VPRO. And I think that the difference is with interfacial crack gel on glass, let's say that from the point of view of fracture, the process zone is very small. The process zone is typically of length xi. It is implicit in my description of the Alashalamak, my description of the fracture. The process zone is simply the last bond you break, okay, xi. And so d of xi has some meaning. Here, in this system, I think we think that the process zone is much larger, and that what happened in the process zone is much more akin to crazes, which Mark knows very well, much more akin to crazes than to a simple debonding. Okay, with simple debonding, you cannot explain the result. So I think that, like in crazes, you have a very pretty large process zone, and of course the good characteristic velocity you have to write down is d over the length, the size of the process zone, which now the velocity will be very low. Okay, so I think that in our regime we are always at velocity much larger than the good poroelastic zone, power elastic velocity, which would correspond to a transition between some, let's say, drained process zone to undrained process zone. Do not forget that there is solvent which can move, and if it have time to move, it's different than if you have time to move out of the good zone where dissipation occurs. But well, this is another story. But to answer your question, no, it is very, very different. So we started this study with an idea, and the idea was not good, so now the study is another story. As usual.
If you try another mode of fracture, because I guess in mode one, it's difficult to reheal.
Yes, it's difficult. You cannot reheal this mode one.
You do it in mode three.
In mode three? Wow, experiment in mode three. Mode three is something for series. For the theory, you know. I don't like mode 3. Well, something which would be interesting would be mode 2 within the gel, because remember that our system shows a very huge contrast, elastic contrast between the gel and the glass. This is known to be a good condition to observe self-healing slip pulses from the work of Adams. Okay, and it sounds reasonable because strong contrast means a strong coupling between the shear stress and the normal stress. And that's the whole story. Now, what happens if, for example, you change the glass plate by a gel plate with a different amount of gelatin? It will be stiffer than the other one, but still there will be a contrast, and then you can match the contrast up to the point where the system will be completely symmetric. Okay, and this, I think, is something which is interesting from the point of view of earthquakes, because as far as I've read in Reiss-Koshar or Ben-Zion and so on, the question is how can we explain that we observe, let's say, Heaton pulses or something, self-healing slip pulses traveling along a fault, when the fault has no reason to be thought as asymmetric from the point of view of elasticity? And well, I think that there would be probably things to be seek in this way. So working in mode two, in the bulk of a mode two, ultimately with the same gel. Well, this remains to be done. Thank you.